Good evening, my friends. I'm Eric Olson, and it's time once again for America's Most Haunted Radio, bringing together the finest minds and personalities from across the paranormal spectrum. With me, as always, is my America's Most Haunted co-author and co-host, the world-famous haunted housewife, Teresa RG.
On this episode of America's Most Haunted, we are talking the Afterlife Files with impresario Todd Moster. But before we do that, it is my pleasure to speak once again to the world-famous haunted housewife, Teresa Argy. How are you doing, Teresa?
Doing great. Snowed in here in beautiful northeast Ohio, but trying to enjoy the days as they come.
Yeah. Boy, talk about a snowy winter after no snow at all, essentially, in December. I mean, we've just been inundated in January. And I got to keep going out there and shoveling that driveway. And, I mean, I got to put on my weight belt. And I got an ice pack inside the weight belt. And then, of course, I'm wearing a coat over all of that. And it just all seems like this convoluted, iron, ironic nightmare. But it's what I got to do, or my back just explodes as I'm shoveling up and down our ridiculous driveway.
The snow is a big hindrance, but for those of you who don't live in our area, you probably have no idea what it is, but it's very cold, it's very deep, and it keeps you pretty much inside the house and away from other pursuits, which is kind of where we're at right now. We haven't been able to do much. The haunted housewives have kind of been on house arrest until the weather breaks a little bit, and then we're going to get back to doing what we do, getting back out there, trying out some new equipment that we acquired over the holidays.
Well, what was that? Tell us.
We got a FLIR camera, kind of on the wish list. My husband surprised me as a combination birthday, anniversary, Christmas present, and we got a FLIR, a thermal imaging camera, which is pretty much by far the most expensive piece of equipment we've ever had. Only used one once when we were on Paranormal Challenge, so this is kind of a commercial version, but it's a good one, and we're anxious to get it going and get it started since it's something new in our arsenal, so we'll see how it works, because we pretty much go old school. So this will be a little bit different, you know, maybe switch from doing just strictly audio, which is where most of our work is, and research, to trying a little video. You know, audio is pretty much the staple of paranormal investigating, but, you know, we're going to try a little bit of everything.
Well, that is certainly appropriate, mentioning audio, given the nature of our show.
Yep.
Today, talking EVPs, electronic voice phenomena. And so let's get into it. An effort to mount one of the most ambitious and decisive scientific explorations of EVP ever launched January 28th on crowdfunding website Kickstarter.com. The Afterlife Files aspires to be a combined scientific expedition and 13-episode TV series designed to get to the bottom of EVP claims. Featuring a collaboration of experienced EVP researchers, skeptics, mainstream scientists, and families seeking contact with departed loved ones, the series will document a landmark effort to solve one of the greatest mysteries of all time. And boy, we talk about that. We agree. You know, anything that brings any sort of objective proof or ostensible objective proof to the afterlife, that's about the biggest issue, the biggest concern, really, in the history of mankind. And I mean, that really is my opinion on it. As Teresa was just saying, audio just seems to have a little more credibility for various reasons. Video, just because of the internet and the whole digital revolution, it seems to be real easy to be doctored and do things with it. People seem somewhat, anyway, less inclined to falsify or doctor audio. And as far as I'm concerned, just me personally, EVP, I mean, that really does seem to be the one thing that I can't figure out where that material would be coming from, other than the paranormal, other than the spiritual realm. It just, I can't think of a source. I mean, is there really signals just bouncing around and being randomly picked up? I guess that's possible. Certainly we know there's all kinds of radio waves out there. But nonetheless, let us bring in producer mastermind of the Afterlife Files, Todd Moster. Welcome, Todd.
Hi, Eric and Teresa. Thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure. Teresa, since you are the veteran investigator, why don't you kick things off talking about EVPs?
Well, first of all, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to speak with you. EVP is obviously the huge topic in the paranormal, and I remember the very first time I caught my first EVP, and actually I remember the first time I heard an EVP, and I was blown away. I mean, it just was such a fascinating subject just to think about. Could it be? Is this actually voices of the dead? I mean, it was astounding. Give us a little bit of your background and your experience with EVPs and how you got into the paranormal and your first experiences with EVPs.
Sure. And thanks for that question, Teresa. Well, I have to say that I've been interested in the paranormal ever since I was a kid. But what really kicked things off for me was in the late 1970s when I was in high school and someone gave me a copy of a book called Breakthrough. That was a book written by a Latvian researcher named Konstantin Rawdive. I think he pronounces his name differently or did. But he had learned about this new area. I don't even think it had been named EVP at that time, in which people running tape recordings, that time they used tape, not digital, had obtained voices or what appeared to be voices that identified themselves and appeared to be deceased people. And he was fascinated by this. And so he began a series of experiments at using various methods over a series of years and compiled literally hundreds, in fact, thousands of different snippets of recordings that he put into this book called Breakthrough. And when I read that, I was absolutely fascinated and I was hooked. And it led to my actually founding a little paranormal research group when I was a student at the University of Florida and something that I was interested in. Then, unfortunately, careers and life takes over, and I became a trial attorney and later an executive recruiter and put things aside for a while until the early 2000s when I thought, hey, you know, I wonder what's become of this area called EVP. And I did an internet search, and I saw that there were claims that the area had progressed extremely far, with very interesting results, both EVPs and images, which people called ITC. And I became hooked all over again. And now, having been a trial attorney and having been a prosecutor for quite a few years, and knowing the value of evidence, I took that new discipline to this area. And so I started interviewing some of the main people involved in the recording. And that led to my producing a mini documentary on EVP in 2008, which was called Breaking the Barrier. And that was really intended to be a vehicle to raise funds for a very elaborate documentary. Like a lot of would-be producers, I attempted to raise the funds. There were conditions imposed, and it was just very difficult. And so when this new crowdfunding movement came to my attention through Kickstarter and things like that, suddenly I realized this could be a whole new way to study the area of EVP, and not only the audio, but also the images under ITC, although, as Eric pointed out, I think there is a lot more possibility for tampering with those types of things. But given the millions and millions of people worldwide who are interested in the paranormal, and the many more people, pretty much all of us, who wonder what really happens to us when we die, it seemed like the perfect platform for a power to the people kind of approach, which is really what crowdfunding is all about. And so that was kind of the genesis of the Afterlife Files. And needless to say, to address your question about what I've experienced, I can't say that I personally have had any paranormal experiences, but in the course of interviewing various people who have done recordings right in front of me, and that's the amazing thing about people who are researchers in EVP, is that they're willing to try any method, and they're willing to do it under whatever conditions you impose, because I think they, like I, started out as skeptics. And so I've been there when a recording machine is running, including my own. You hear nothing. You play it back, and suddenly you hear something that definitely sounds like a voice. And as I'm sure that you know, Teresa, EVP voices mostly seem to have a certain rhythm to them that's distinctive and a little different from the way we speak in real life. And so I thought this was just a fascinating area that needs even more investigation, and that's pretty much why I'm here.
Why don't we talk specifically about this really ambitious project of yours, the Afterlife Files? And I know you launched about a week ago. How are things going? And we got to tell people how to get there, of course.
Absolutely. And thank you for asking. Well, we are seeing an increase in momentum. Now, we've got quite a ways to go. The Afterlife Files is seeking a fundraising goal of $500,000, which I know sounds crazy. But we wanted to be sure that if we got our funding, we would be able to carry out the promise we're making to our backers. And that promise is to mount the most ambitious, the most far-reaching, and the most controlled experiment of EVP and also ITC images ever done. And the way that we intend to do that is to build upon the experience of people like Teresa and you, as, in terms of people who have been doing EVPs and have developed techniques, but to also bring in mainstream scientists who generally tend to run away from things like this because they're afraid of selling their reputation. I found that out in my earlier mini-documentary when I tried to interview some of those folks. But with a big budget, we expect that we'll be able to pay these types of folks the consulting fees that they're used to getting, that will hopefully take out some of the embarrassment from the equation and actually compensate them for their time, along with insurances of integrity and that sort of thing. So you've got an investigation that's going to be ready to move into new territory by a group of experts that include paranormal investigators, some diehard skeptics, mainstream scientists, families who are searching for lost loved ones. And they're going to put together the protocol. We're going to get the most expensive, or hopefully not the most expensive, but some of the most sensitive audio equipment and facilities available so that we can absolutely eliminate possibilities, like you mentioned, Eric, of inadvertently recording pieces of radio transmissions and that sort of thing, and to eliminate tampering. So that's about one half of what the Afterlife Files is about. The other half, I have to say, is kind of showbiz. It's going to be a documentary-style reality TV series, 13 episodes, half-hour episodes, that basically documents the whole process of this coming together. So people will see as we recruit the important people involved, as we put them together in a team, as they work together to create a protocol. And these are people who come from vastly different perspectives. So there are bound to be some clashes, and I'm going to play the role pretty much, having acted as a volunteer judge in my attorney days, as sort of the mediator to make sure people get along and that this experiment moves forward. And so we hope to take this study into areas where it's never come before. And as you both were saying, this is amazing. I mean, if EVPs really are voices of people who have died and our consciousness continues after physical death, and so you can get that in audio form or in video form or whatever, it would be absolutely amazing. And yet this kind of work has been going on now for decades, and it still has yet to really hit the public consciousness. And the reason is, why is that? And I think part of the reason is you've got all of these amazing people, brilliant people who are working in the area, but they all are in some way committed to investigating the paranormal. And so what the Afterlife Files will do is to take the expertise of these people add some people who have never actually been involved in the paranormal and may be outwardly and genuinely very skeptical about the subject, but bring them and their expertise in. And then with people like that also participating and having ownership of the investigation, you get recordings, whether audio or video, that can't be explained conventionally. Well, then we think you're going to have a paradigm shifting event that could really change the world, and that's what we're after.
Whoa, well, that's not much.
I know. Sometimes my wife compares me to Don Quixote, you know, saying, you're only taking on the question of whether there's life after death. I mean, that's good to start small, right? But that's what you're doing, Eric, and that's what you're doing, Teresa. And we're just hoping to build on your expertise and enthusiasm to take this to its next logical step.
What kind of response are you getting thus far to your ambitious project? What are some of the, say, specific feedback and reaction? And do you have people committed to it, at least tentatively?
We do have people committed, and tentatively is actually a very good word, because this might be a good time to explain how Kickstarter works. Kickstarter is a crowdfunding platform where people can give pledges of whatever amount they feel appropriate, anywhere from $5 all the way to thousands of dollars. And in return, we have lots of rewards, fun prizes, basically, on our website that are given for different levels of contribution. Anything from a free download of our prior mini documentary, Breaking the Barrier, to a book about famous grave sites throughout the country signed by the author, music downloads. At the upper levels, we have associate and producer credits and private visits to the set during production. But one of the key features of Kickstarter is that pledges are not redeemed unless you reach your fundraising goal within your campaign period. So once you start, there are two things that you can't change in a Kickstarter campaign. You can't change the length of your campaign, and you can't change your fundraising goal. So we committed to 40 days and a goal of $500,000. So if, let's say, that we get to the end of our campaign, which comes around March 8th, and we have, let's say, $490,000, but we haven't reached $500,000. Well, all of the generous pledges that have been made, they actually won't be redeemed. They're kind of being held in escrow by Amazon, which works with Kickstarter. But it just doesn't happen, and the campaign fails. But that's a risk that we're willing to take, because that's part of the excitement of why Kickstarter is probably one of the most successful crowdfunding platforms, because it builds excitement and urgency. Kickstarter strongly recommends that most campaigns be about 30 days in length, although you can go up to 60 days. And so what we opted to do, since this is our first Kickstarter campaign as a team, was to do 40 days, meaning, well, we have an initial 10-day period to kind of get out the kinks and make some big mistakes and sort of begin to build public awareness, and then go into the actual 30-day period of the campaign. So we're now out about 7-8 days, and we've got about $3,000 with just beginning to build momentum, but lots of people contacting us, lots of interviews being scheduled, interest building. So we know we have a pretty gargantuan task ahead of us. We don't know whether we'll succeed, but we're very optimistic. And our view is, with millions of people worldwide, I mean, just in the UK, the US, and Canada, let's say, you have millions of people who listen to your broadcast and similar broadcasts. If we can just get a few thousand of them to give a modest pledge, then we're there. And so that's what our target is.
Interesting. I've heard what a lot of people do, or at least some people do, is they hold in reserve fairly large tentative pledges so that if they do get close, but it looks like they're in danger of not getting over that, they're able to kind of plop those in at the end. You know anything about that? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I have heard that, and that's what I call the Dutch uncle phenomenon.
Right.
I think that it can be done. I wish I had some wealthy Dutch uncles, but I come from a pretty humble background. But I can say that, let's say that we got to the point of being, say, $10,000 or $20,000 away from our goal. I don't think I could go on living in this world unless I was able to close the gap, and I would suddenly find some people I think who would be able to close the gap. So in a sense, all pledges made in a Kickstarter campaign are tentative, because
right.
it's all subject to whether you reach your fundraising goal. But if we get close, I have no doubt that Dutch uncle or not, we'll find a way to close the gap and get this project going.
Tad, it seems to me like you've painted yourself into a corner with such a short time. I've seen Kickstarter campaigns that last months and months and months, and they have time to gain the momentum. I mean, it would just be such a shame to for this not to happen with all the work you've put in the planning. Was there an option to possibly, I know you mentioned that you decided on the 40 days for a certain reason, but maybe a lesser goal and maybe a slower and steadier campaign to get that? Because what happens? What happens if this doesn't happen? Do you try again and change your dollar amount or your time? Or what is the option just in case this doesn't come to fruition? Are you going to throw in the towel? Are you going to go a different direction or just try it again?
Fantastic question, Teresa. And those hard questions were ones that we really deeply debated, as you might expect, before we actually made our final decisions as to how we were going to do the campaign. And Kickstarter has changed over the years. I believe Kickstarter launched around 2008, 2009. But the rules are a little different now, and the maximum campaign you're allowed to do in Kickstarter is only 60 days. Now, there are other crowdfunding platforms like Indiegogo, and I think there's one called Rocket Hub, which have different rules. So the most we could have gone is 60 days. When you're thinking about putting together your campaign, Kickstarter actually gives you some statistics. And they strongly urge 30 days because they say no matter what the goal is, those seem to be the most successful because they build some urgency. So we felt, okay, well, you know, we really should go by what Kickstarter says, but we, like you said, we need time to build momentum. So we're going to give ourselves another 10 days. But, you know, I think your criticism is valid. You know, have we painted ourselves into a corner? Can this be achieved? And the answer is, we don't know. We're certainly going to try. But if we do not succeed, what happens? Do we throw in the towel? And the answer is no. Many successful Kickstarter campaigns have actually started before as a prior Kickstarter campaign. And on the basis of supporters gathered and lessons learned, they started again. For example, one of the most successful Kickstarter campaigns ever mounted was by a musician named Amanda Palmer. And she did a Kickstarter campaign and was not successful. But on the basis of what she had experienced, she mounted another one and she raised something like $1.4 million for an album and I think a book that she was putting on. I would have to say that I've never really used the term bucket list in my life, but I have to say if there's only one thing on my bucket list, it's getting a a definitive scientific process going like is envisioned by the Afterlife Files and getting it filmed and distributed. So even if this Kickstarter campaign is not successful, it will be done either as a reinvented Kickstarter or some other crowdfunding platform or something else. So we know we're taking a risk. I actually went to a Kickstarter class a few weeks ago as I was putting this together from someone who did a successful Kickstarter campaign, and she said something that resonated with me. She said, look, you can't be afraid of failure. Let's say you're walking down the street and you trip. What are you going to do? Are you going to stay there, or are you going to get up and keep on walking? So I thought that was a really good image, and we're going to get across the finish line even if we're stumbling.
What about if I'm thinking ahead because my mind is spinning with the possibility of this project. Say you get your funding, you got a green light, you're going for it, the project kicks out. During the course of this endeavor, what a 13 episode series or whatever project you do, if it goes to TV or not, what would be your best result as far as evidential proof or EVPs? What if, say, the scientists, because I think it's, I applaud you for trying to get mainstream scientists on board, because I know that this is a tough sell for them. But do you think that you'll be able to find major breakthroughs, or are you just trying to kind of focus all the interest on the possibility that this can happen? Or do you think that you can really find something that's physically by evidential proof going to change minds?
Great question. The essence of a fair investigation, of course, is that you don't know what is going to result. So we have to be prepared for the possibility that we might gather the most brilliant investigators around, the best equipment, and get absolutely nothing. It'll still be an interesting show no matter what because of all the people involved and what they're after. But certainly, if there's something to this area, and like I said, I start out sort of from the skeptical standpoint. I, as a prosecutor, have built hundreds of cases based upon evidence, and I kind of want to get something together that will could stand up in court. So one of the working hypotheses that we have, and I think you as a paranormal investigator will immediately recognize it, is that if there's something to EVP, there seem to be certain people who are more experienced at producing them or images who can produce them time and time again. What is the reason for that? Hard to say. Does it just get something you get better at it with time? It's hard to say. But that's why part of our team and one of the core parts of our team will be experienced paranormal investigators and people who have obtained EVPs or images in the past. Because our assumption is that if we get those people involved, we will have a better chance of producing EVPs than we wouldn't have otherwise. So I guess in talking about what is our dream result, well, let's say that we have these people involved, and yet these people don't have personal access to the equipment, so you have the most tightly controlled coordinates in existence, and you have these the electronic engineers from, say, places like MIT or University of Chicago, whatever, and they're all there. And so you have this recording equipment running, and your meters indicate that something's being recorded, and you play it back, and you're getting what they call a Class A voice, let's say, that is clearly recognizable by anyone. And let's say it makes reference to something that's going on at the time or specific name of someone involved. Well, if you get something like that, under those tightly observed circumstances with people involved who don't believe in it at all, that is going to be, to me, a transformative event that hasn't happened yet. So that is sort of the dream circumstances that I, as a producer, or I helping a paranormal investigation, would like to see. Will it happen? Well, we'll just have to see how the science and the production unfolds.
Well, Todd, I know you've at least taken a look at our America's Most Haunted book, and of course, in the course of that, the Haunted Housewives and Teresa individually and I as well were in a number of circumstances where we believe that EVPs were absolutely produced. Teresa, why don't you mention a few of the most vivid and for you the most indelible of the EVPs that you yourself have heard and or captured?
Well, the one that sticks out the most, especially for anybody who's familiar with our book, is probably the ones that come from the Ohio State Reformatory, the old prison in Mansfield, also known as the Shawshank Prison, where Shawshank Redemption was filmed. That particular chapter in our book kind of talks about several different investigations that we did, and some of the EVPs that we got there. We were there with a group one time, and this was probably the first time I got an EVP that was so very personal and aggressive. And we believe we contacted the spirit of a gentleman named Mike, and I use gentleman loosely. And he was, we think, a prisoner at one point at the prison. And in talking to him, he had different reactions. It was the same voice. He had different reactions depending on who was asking the questions. And he most definitely did not like me and threatened me, cussed and swore at me several times. And then on repeat visits, when we went back to do other investigations, the same voice, the same way. With my partner, Kathy, he was cooperative and pleasant to a point. And whenever I addressed the question, it would be this just horrible screaming and yelling. So we think that he definitely didn't like me. But the interesting thing about that EVP and those that set of EVPs with that particular spirit is we captured the same voice at different locations for several years afterwards. We did locations that were not even in the state of Ohio. And the very distinctive voice of Mike would come up on our recordings, even using different recordings, even using different recording devices. And the same voice would come up at other places. So we believe this spirit was actually following Kathy around. So that, to me, that went beyond just, oh, I captured a spirit voice. This was, I captured a spirit voice of a spirit that doesn't like me that's actually following us around. So that became a whole separate issue in itself. And we also believe that this spirit has appeared to Kathy because she has seen shadow figures in her house, which she does believe are this. So that was the one EVP. That went beyond, ooh, I caught a spirit voice. That was something to me that was very personal and very compelling. And nobody can explain that away to me, no matter what they do.
And I have to say that that is absolutely the kind of validation that we would be looking for. And by the way, I did read your book, and I think it's fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
And I love the way that it integrates both sort of an objective history of the various sites that you talk about with first-person accounts like you just gave us, Teresa, of actually recording the EVPs or things that you experienced and what you concluded from that. And certainly the kind of event that you're talking about where you get the same name or the same quality of voice at different times and all relating to the same thing certainly is indicative of something going on out of the ordinary because let's say that it's an errant radio transmission or CB radio, whatever, that's picked up inadvertently, if that were even possible. Well, what are the chances of that name or that quality of voice or if obscene things were being said coming over the air? It's very unlikely. And actually, there is, you had asked earlier about paranormal events that had happened to me. Again, I come from a little bit of a skeptical standpoint, but one thing I actually have not revealed in the Afterlife Files yet or in an interview actually does come to mind, which is about 9 years ago when I was doing an interview for Breaking the Barrier, the earlier documentary. I was interviewing a woman named Vicki Talbot who lost her 21-year-old son, Braden, unfortunately, in a kayaking accident and was very good at getting EVPs, as she believed, from him and from others. And I had actually a little tape recorder cassette with me at the time. And so we did an EVP session with that. We ran it through her computer. And one of the things that sounded like a recognizable voice was a man. It sounded like someone with an English accent saying, "He's not fazed a bit." Well, let's go to years later. And I'm now in production for what would become the Afterlife Files. And I'm doing an EVP session with another woman named Margaret Downey. This was after my father had passed away. But during the course of this EVP session, there was a recording made. And this is actually one of the things that's on a little video that's on our Kickstarter site. We have the main video, which is a video trailer. But then we have a concentrated video showing some of the EVPs that we got during filming for the Afterlife Files. And there's one section where my name is being used. Just somebody saying my name. And first it's said by a woman. And then it's said by a man. And the man who says my name sounds exactly to me, like that same person with an English accent who made that earlier, or seemed to make that earlier recording years before when I was doing Breaking the Barrier. So again, it's hard for me to maintain objectivity when I see or hear things like that happening, but I certainly think that's interesting and why it's worth all this energy to try to make something like this happen.
I should add, excuse me, in Teresa's case with the mic and it's believed that we've even, or they were able to identify his last name as Evans. And what's most amazing or equally amazing, the final circle, piece of the circle of amazingness for me, is in the very area where Teresa and Kathy first encountered Mike, down in the basement, the dungeon, essentially, of the Ohio State Reformatory. There is often paint that peels off because it's very damp down there. So kind of every time it rains hard, the dampness seeps down to the basement and a layer of paint will start chipping off. So that happened in one of these cells, and as a layer of paint peeled away, there was graffiti signed by Mike Evans in that very area where they first encountered him. So my goodness, that was some sort of pretty crazy objective validation, as far as I was concerned anyway. I thought that was really quite amazing, because now you're sort of, you're mixing your metaphors, as it were. You're mixing your sources of validation. You have something written, you have something objective from when he was alive and almost certainly incarcerated there. And there was even a date on it, and some more writing that seemed to be in the same hand. But again, most impressively, was simply the name in that very place where they first encountered him. And that first encounter, it wasn't just the two of them. There was quite a group there. So this was witnessed by a number of people. Yeah, I agree. That's one of the more amazing incidents that we were able to relate. And yes, thank you so much, Todd. That is very nice to hear. We like to think that combination of objective historical data and research, we were able to come up with some information that isn't well known anyway, and we were able to more or less verify some of the legends, or at least the facts behind some of the legends at these various locations. And we were able also to debunk some of them. And that felt very gratifying, to be able to bring kind of real hard research and information into the real world, apart even really from the paranormal aspects, which is, of course, the focus of it. What I wanted to, what we haven't done yet really, is please let's tell the listeners, how do they get to that actual Kickstarter page? Because we want to see this thing come to fruition, because who knows, maybe we'll be involved.
You never know. And as a matter of fact, that's obviously I'm going to use the term when we get started, whether it's through this Kickstarter campaign or something else. We're obviously going to be going to people like you who have a lot of experience, because we don't want to reinvent the wheel. We want to start absolutely at the peak of where research can take us and then move into absolutely new territory. So very easy. Kickstarter makes it so easy to make a pledge. You just go to Kickstarter.com. And they've got a page that comes up, and at the very top there's a little search box with one of those little magnifying glasses. And you just type in Afterlife Files, and it'll come right up. You just click on where you see our logo. There's a very distinctive logo we have for the campaign, which is a woman seen from the back looking in through a dark tunnel with a light in front of her. So as soon as you see that logo, you double-click on it. You go to the page. It says the Afterlife Files right on top. There's you can see immediately is our main trailer video. It's 8 minutes long, which really tells the whole story of the Afterlife Files and what we want to accomplish. And right to the right is a little green box. I believe it says Make a Pledge or something like that. And all you need to do is click on that, and it takes you right through the process. Now, with Kickstarter and pretty much most, if not all, of the crowdfunding sites on the internet, you do need to use a credit card. They don't take PayPal, but you can use any credit card. But they use Amazon. So obviously, it's about as safe as one can get with using the internet, and they just make it so easy. So you can have it done in a matter of 3 minutes or so. And when you go on our website, you'll not only see the main trailer and a couple of other little videos, but you'll also have some text that explains where we're coming from. You'll see all the fun rewards that we're offering at different levels. You might as well get some swag, you know, if you're going to the trouble of making a pledge. And so we have all kinds of fun things for people. But the most important thing is people will become our backers. They'll be our inside team. And we'll be letting them know once the production starts of everything that happens. We'll be giving them new developments, talking about new discoveries that are made. And we will actually be considering all of our backers co-producers. So again, just go to Kickstarter.com, www.kickstarter.com. On the search box at the top, just type in Afterlife Files, Afterlife, one word, files. It'll come up. You'll see the woman in the tunnel. Double click, then go to the right and say Make a Pledge. Read it, and more importantly, tell your friends and your relatives, even your enemies, about it. Because we can do this if our video and if our project goes viral. That's how the power to the people concept of crowdfunding will work for us. And people are, in fact, spreading our message by Facebook, by Twitter. We've been retweeted many, many times. There have been people talking about emails. I'm sorry, there's a phone call coming, but I'm going to take care of that. But the most important way for something to go viral is for people just to talk to other people. It goes back to old-fashioned communication. People tell other people that they know are interested in the subject about the Afterlife Files, and it goes on and on and on. So we've gotten a good number of pledges so far. Some are from people who know me, obviously, but we are getting an increase in many pledges now for people who have just found out about us on the internet, or they've heard an interview or something like that, and we need to see a big increase in that in the next 33 or 34 days. And if that happens, and that's a big if, but if it happens, we will cross the finish line and hope to start putting our team together as early as April.
And we have links to your website and to the Afterlife Files and everything on our websites as well. So on the America's Most Haunted page, on our Facebook, and we're also retweeting on Twitter. So maybe our followers and our friends and family can also get on board and help get this moving as well.
Yeah, I want to add, it's a really well put together project. I get, you know, as you can imagine, just getting all the different press releases and whatnot, I get all kinds of pitches about Kickstarter projects, and, you know, I try to at least check them all out. And this one is very, very well put together just in terms of its logic and its flow. I mean, if you're just interested in EVPs just in the broadest sense, you have no thought in the world of, you know, participating in the funding aspect, it is a very well put together analysis of the background of EVPs, the theories of EVPs, and then, of course, obviously, it's a very well planned out a business plan for and project plan for what they're going to do. So even just purely from an informational standpoint, I think it's a really, really interesting page to read. And I think anyone who's potentially interested in participating, in buying into it, as it were, I think you'll really be encouraged by how well put together it is and how professional. And so that's certainly something I noticed right away. Incidentally, just in terms of the America's Most Haunted site, there's also an earlier interview I did with Todd in written form and text form that's prior to the launch of the project, prior to a week ago anyway, and that's up on the America's Most Haunted site. So you can get additional information. We talked about a little bit, you know, every interview, a little bit different. You get into a little bit different territory, so that might flesh out some of what we've been talking about as well. Yeah, it's really a fascinating project. I think your commitment to going the crowdfunding route makes a lot of sense. It shows a lot of courage, and I think you've really kind of thrown yourself into it in a way that nothing guarantees success, of course, but I think you're certainly setting yourself up for the best possible chance to succeed on this. And certainly it's the project in and of itself, just purely the information and the entertainment value of it. I'm just chomping at the bit to see how it comes together. I think it's just going to be amazing. And I love the idea, as Teresa mentioned earlier, that you are bringing in skeptics. You're bringing in scientists who in essence will be looking to debunk this, really. So if they are convinced, if anything gets through their net, then that really will mean something. And I think that will spread to, that information will spread to a broader audience than typically paranormal, purely paranormal projects get. So I absolutely commend you on that approach and the seriousness that you brought to it.
Well, thank you very much, Eric. And I've got to say that what has made it easy to build the Afterlife Files, obviously there was a lot of effort that went into it, but so much excellent work has been done in the area of EVP and also video or visual images through ITC by some brilliant people who were all so accessible and eager to help when we were putting this together. Because one of the feature characteristics of people like you and like Teresa and all the hundreds and thousands of paranormal investigators who are all throughout the world is sort of an objective science view basis or a perspective on what they're doing, because we've all been raised in the space age or after the space age, and we have that perspective. And so that discipline has been brought to the study. And so I already had sort of a loose structure of how to put this together. And I think now, with decades of research, especially since the active research started with Friedrich Jurgensen, one of the first people who investigated EVP back in the 1950s, who also, incidentally, was a TV producer. But since then, you have a steady progress of technological and scientific advancement. I think now we're at the perfect stage to take this to the next level. And if so, we will break through as far as paranormal investigation from something that's just in the echo chamber of everybody who's already interested in the subject to something that perhaps you'll have a discovery that's going to be on CNN every day for at least a week and on the cover of every major newspaper. This is something that, if there's really something to it, may just be ready to hit the mainstream. And we hope to be on the vanguard of making that happen.
Yeah, boy, that would certainly be exciting. Hey, we've kind of danced around the basic topic, but I would be very, very interested to hear explicitly what both you, Todd, and Teresa, what are your personal theories? What are your personal beliefs on what EVP could be? What is the range? What are the various possibilities? What could these things be?
Well, starting with me, and I know Teresa will probably have some interesting theories, since I'm coming from sort of an objective point of view, I think the first thing that I will need to see is whether we can exclude all other conventional explanations for EVP. And I know that people like Teresa and you who have worked in the field personally for so many years, that seems really obvious. But I want to make sure that we have eliminated all other possible explanations scientifically, such as errant TV or radio transmissions, or a really well-documented phenomenon that lots of people, including EVP researchers, acknowledge, which is kind of reading something into something that's a little vague. So it's something that putting order into chaos, something that we do with painting sometimes, or just general patterns. The human brain will create a pattern out of chaos when there's really nothing there. So so first I want to get there. Then once we get something that is really something that you can't explain conventionally, so you've got a class A audio or visual recording that everybody would agree it's saying something, or it is X, then what is the reason for X? And that becomes something that's a real fascinating philosophical subject. And I expect that when we get to that stage in the Afterlife Files, we'll go out and we'll talk to quantum mechanics, physicists and people like that who will have all sorts of theories these days about alternate universes and amazing theories that are actually in the mainstream in physics these days that 50 years ago no one would have believed could even be possible. So if you document this as a real occurrence that is beyond our normal understanding, then you're just opening up the door to a variety of fascinating theories to explain it. So that's about the best that I could do, but I bet Teresa has some really excellent observations on this.
Well, my standpoint might be slightly different. I mean, I've been at this for many, many years, and I do believe that there's scientific explanations, maybe ones that we haven't figured out yet, but we will eventually, at least for a good portion of what we call now the paranormal. I think that things that we find now have no explanation in decades or a few years down the line, there will be an explanation. It's just something that we can't understand with our current knowledge. But I also strongly believe that there is part of this that maybe we won't ever be able to fully understand, and because it can't be explained by science. And that might be what some people call a religious belief or whatever their particular spiritual dogma is. I believe that portions of our personality, of our spirit, of our soul do remain here on Earth or come back to visit or whatever after we die, whether by choice or by accident or whatever. I do believe that that happens. I don't believe in souls being trapped here. I do believe that it might be just a portion of what we call our energy, our essence. And that I do believe will be something that science can explain. It's some sort of energy field or something. But I think that there's more to it than that. And there is going to be an element that will not be fully explainable by science. But I believe that science will get to the point where we won't be able to deny that these things are happening. If it is radio waves, if there's a study that says, look, I can prove this is a radio wave, I can prove where it's coming from. Well, who's manipulating that radio wave to answer your questions directly? Why are you getting a direct personal answer from a radio wave or whatever source it may be coming from if that's directed towards you? There's just too much that can't be explained. I do believe that that there is something to misidentification and to our mind-seeking patterns. But there's so much that's unexplainable. And I believe that, like, I personally take that on faith. I believe that there's something more to that, that there's something spiritual in that besides what we can see, what we can quantify with numbers or in a lab or with evidence. I have a problem with evidence sometimes because it is so easily manipulated. But I think that it's going to be a combination of both. I think that science is going to figure out a huge portion of this, but there's always going to be that part that we can't explain, and that's okay. I'm good with that. That's fine with me. I think we're going to be changing a lot of minds pretty soon, though. I think the next couple decades, there's going to be a lot of people who were skeptics who won't be able to deny the fact that there is something there and that this does happen.
So Teresa does not live in an entirely mechanistic universe. I don't either.
Absolutely not.
I don't either. I have to add. And my personal thoughts are actually pretty similar to what Teresa just said. I think a lot of this will end up being explained. But remember, just because something can be explained still doesn't really get at necessarily what the cause is. You may know how something happens, but you don't necessarily know why something happens. That's what I always come back to. The deeper and the farther we get into coming up with, or the closer we get to literally creating life, the first life, you know, how did that first life come to be? And the closer we're able to put together the chemicals and the circumstances and so on and so forth that led to that, or that precipitated that, that still doesn't tell us, well, why did it happen? You know, why did this thing that ultimately ended up evolving into self-conscious beings such as ourselves, you know, why did that happen? How is it that this universe, or why is it that this universe is set up in such a way that such a thing could happen? So even when you get to the mechanical explanations of things, there are still underlying issues that really aren't necessarily taken into account. All right. Well, we just went into pretty great detail on how people can track down the Afterlife Files Kickstarter page, and we really recommend just anyone interested in either EVP, certainly, obviously, the paranormal in general, or even how Kickstarter works. I think it'd be well worthwhile checking out the Afterlife Files page on Kickstarter. We haven't really told people how to get a hold of you in other ways, though. So how else can people reach you and reach out to you and get the information that you're putting out there, Todd?
Thanks for asking, Eric. People can also feel free to email me at afterlifefiles@gmail.com. afterlifefiles@gmail.com. And I will do everything I can to answer every email or every inquiry personally and quickly, because this obviously, even objective ideas in mind, is obviously a passion for me. And every person who inquires or even criticizes or injects skepticism in the process is someone that I want to talk to, because this is a subject that I think everybody thinks about. What happens to us and our loved ones after we die? This is the one universal feature that affects every human being. And that's really what the core of the Afterlife Files is all about. So people can contact me through email, certainly by making a contribution on the website. In addition, we have a Facebook page, which is called Afterlife Files. So just go to Facebook and put in search term Afterlife Files, and we'll come right up. We have a Twitter page, which is at Afterlife Files. You may be detecting a theme here. So we're very easy.
It's called branding.
It's called branding. There you go. So we're out there. As a lot of information is out there to be gathered, and we think new information, and that's what the Afterlife Files is all about. And that's why I really appreciate you're both bringing me on to spread the word about this, because it can be done. We just need help. And we need a few thousand people giving us support and backing and becoming part of the project. And once that happens, we will get this done. It's only a small percentage of the people out there with this same passion and capability to give us a little bit of support.
Fantastic. Any closing thoughts, Teresa?
I just wish you luck. I hope that you get the backing that you need in this project comes to fruition. It would be very interesting to see a serious and detailed and thorough study of this brought to the mainstream. So I wish you luck.
Thank you so much, Teresa and Eric. I really appreciate your bringing me on today.
Our pleasure, Todd, and I second. We wish you the best of luck with the project. Love to see the result of it. Love to just see any well thought out, well put together paranormal project come to fruition, because there's always things to be learned. And sounds like, you know, on top of that, this should be a very entertaining project as well. So we wish you the best, and we will certainly be tracking the progress throughout the next 30-some days very, very closely. All right. Well, thank you all very much for tuning in, and we'll be listing all the various places shortly here where you can find us, of course. We're America's Most Haunted. I'm Eric Olson, and with me today has been Teresa Argy, the Haunted Housewife, and Todd Moster, who is the brains behind the Afterlife Files. Have a great day, everybody. America's Most Haunted, The Secrets of Famous Paranormal Places is now an epic book from Berkeley Penguin. History, legends, investigations, interviews, and profiles of America's 10 Most Haunted Hotspots by Eric Olson and Haunted Housewife Teresa Argy. Be sure to join us on Twitter and Facebook at AM Haunted, Pinterest at America's Most Haunted, and our website, americas-most-haunted.com. And here every week on America's Most Haunted Radio with all the top names in the paranormal field.